The word of the Lord that came to Joel, the son of Pethuel. Hear this, you elders. Give ear, all inhabitants of the land. Has such a thing happened in your days or in the days of your fathers? Tell your children of it, and let your children tell their children, and let their children to another generation. What the cutting locust left, the swarming locust has eaten. What the swarming locust left, the hopping locust has eaten. And what the hopping locust left, the destroying locust has eaten. Awake, you drunkards, and weep and wail, all you drinkers of wine, because of the sweet wine, for it is cut off from your mouth. For a nation has come up against my land, powerful and beyond number. Its teeth are lion's teeth, and it has the fangs of a lioness. It has laid waste my vine and splintered my fig tree. It has stripped off their bark and thrown it down. Their branches are made white. Lament like the virgin wearing sackcloth for the bridegroom of her youth. The grain offering and the drink offering are cut off from the house of the Lord. The priests mourn, the ministers of the Lord. The fields are destroyed, the ground mourns because the grain is destroyed. The wine dries up, the oil languishes. Be ashamed, O tillers of the soil. Wail, O vine dressers. For the wheat and the barley, because the harvest of the field has finished. The vine dries up, the fig tree languishes. Pomegranate, palm, and apple, all the trees of the field, are dried up, and gladness dries up from the children of man. Put on sackcloth and lament, O priests, wail, O ministers of the altar. Go in, pass the night in sackcloth, O ministers of my God, because grain offering and drink offering are withheld from the house of your God. Consecrate a fast, call a solemn assembly, gather the elders and all the inhabitants of the land to the house of the Lord your God, and cry out to the Lord. Alas for the day! For the day of the Lord is near, and as destruction from the Almighty it comes. Is not the food cut off before our eyes, joy and gladness from the house of our God? The seed shrivels under the clods, the storehouses are desolate, the granaries are torn down because the grain has dried up. How the beasts groan! The herds of cattle are perplexed because there's no pasture for them. Even the flocks of sheep suffer. To you, O Lord, I call. For fire has devoured the pastures of the wilderness, and flame has burned all the trees of the fields. Even the beasts of the field pant for you because the water brooks are dried up, and fire has devoured the pastures of the wilderness. Blow a trumpet in Zion, sound an alarm on my holy mountain. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble, for the day of the Lord is coming, it is near. A day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and thick darkness, like blackness there is spread upon the mountains, a great and powerful people. Their like has never been before, nor will be again after them, through the years of all generations. Fire devours before them, and behind them a flame burns. The land is like the Garden of Eden before them, but behind them a desolate wilderness, and nothing escapes them. Their appearance is like the appearance of horses, and like war horses they run, as with the rumbling of chariots they leap atop the mountains, like crackling of flame of fire, devouring the stubble like a powerful army drawn up for battle. Before them peoples are in anguish, all faces grow pale. Like warriors they charge, like soldiers they scale the wall, they march each on his way, they do not swerve from their path, they do not jostle one another, each marches in his path, they burst through weapons and are not halted. They leap upon the city, they run upon the walls, they climb up into the houses, they enter through windows like a thief. The earth quakes before them, the heavens tremble, the sun and the moon are darkened, and the stars withdraw their shining. The Lord utters his voice before his army, for his camp is exceedingly great. He who executes his word is powerful, for the day of the Lord is great and very awesome. Who can endure it?
Well, I must admit that before I started preparing these talks in Joel, I'd never really taken a plague of locusts that seriously. I don't know about you, but it conjures up all kinds of slightly cartoonish images for me. It's a bit of a cliche, isn't it? Besides, I thought, how much damage can a few hundred insects really do? Well, having learned a lot about locusts since then, I'm happy to admit that I could not have been more wrong. Locusts are terrifying. Most of the time, they're just normal grasshoppers. And then occasionally, when the conditions are right, they go crazy, breed like rabbits, and eat everything. The effects can be devastating on a local environment, all the more so because locusts tend to swarm just after periods of drought. And you can forget what I said about a few hundred insects as well. In 2004, during a locust plague in West Africa, one swarm of locusts, one of several swarms in that particular plague that year, measured 250 kilometers long. That's 155 miles of locusts. And it was at least 150 meters wide at every point. It was estimated by the UN to contain 69 billion locusts. Swarms of several billion locusts are, it turns out, not actually that unusual. Wikipedia tells me that they happen somewhere in the Middle East, about once every 15 years or so. Our reading makes clear that the situation in the background of the book of Joel is the destruction caused by a plague of locusts. But this clearly isn't your once in every 15 years kind of locust swarm. It's a disaster on an unheard of scale. See in verse 2 and 3, Joel calls the elders of the people and asks, "Have you ever seen anything like this? Do you remember your parents telling you about a plague of locusts like this?" The answer is obviously no. Maybe there had been locusts before, but nothing worth comparing to this swarm. In fact, this swarm is such a big deal that the Israelites are to make sure it's passed on to their children, their grandchildren, even their great-grandchildren. Just as generations later, we're still commemorating World War I, this locust plague is something that they'll still be talking about decades and centuries later. But why are we talking about it today? What was it about a plague of locusts a couple of thousand years ago that God wants us to learn now? Joel thinks that this is a plague of locusts that's worth our while to take seriously. Looking at the disaster long ago is meant to teach us key truths about how God and his plans for the world. If we grasp those truths, this little book will turn the way we view our world, our futures, and our lives upside down. The first thing we need to know if we're going to understand this book is that Joel is absolutely clear that the plague of locusts is coming as a judgment against Israel from God. It's not just a natural disaster or a humanitarian crisis. From start to finish, Joel assumes that this plague of locusts has come as a result of God's judgment against his people. That makes sense because the relationship that God established with Israel when he rescued them from slavery, what's called the covenant, clearly states that if Israel turns away from God, one of the ways God will punish that disobedience is through locusts. That's in Deuteronomy 28 for your notes, but don't look it up now. So when a once-in-a-century locust plague tears through Israel, it's right to see the hand of God in judgment against his people. And that judgment has consumed everything. God's judgment has consumed everything. There's no pun intended there. It's quite literally true. The locust plague has caused such devastation that everything has been completely destroyed. Look at verse 4. What the cutting locust left, the swarming locust has eaten. What the swarming locust left, the hopping locust has eaten. And what the hopping locust left, the destroying locust has eaten. The scene is one of complete and utter devastation. Wave after wave of locusts have come in, each one destroying more and more. Everything in their path has been consumed. Perhaps you would have thought that it wasn't so bad when the cutting locust left, until the swarming locust arrived. Maybe after the swarming locust had left, you might have taken a deep breath and said to yourself, okay, there's no denying this is pretty bad. It's going to be really tough, but we'll bounce back. It'll be okay. Until that is, the hopping locust arrived. After the hopping locust had left, as you look at the bare crumbs they'd left behind, I guess you'd ask yourself, is there going to be anything left? Anything at all? And as you saw the cloud of destroying locusts approaching, you'd know for sure that there wouldn't be a thing. Not a thing. It's all gone. Everything. In case there's any doubt about that, Joel walks us through the catalogue of things that have been consumed by the locusts. Verse 9 says, the daily grain and wine offerings have been cut off from the temple. Under the circumstances, maybe you think that's the least of our worries. But Israel's relationship with God revolves around sacrifices. These ones are offered twice daily. If God's judgment has left you with nothing to sacrifice, it's a clear sign that your relationship is broken. If God doesn't want your offerings, what does that say about how he feels about you? He's angry, and he wants you to know that we can't carry on as if everything's okay. It's like if a loved one sent back your letters unopened. The message is clear. We're not in a relationship anymore. The basics of everyday life are gone too. The ground is mourning, verse 10, because the grain is destroyed. The wine dries up. The oil languishes. Grain, wine, oil, these things are the bread and butter of that region. If the grain's been destroyed, there's no bread to eat. If the wine has dried up, there's nothing safe to drink. If the oil is languishing, then cooking, cleaning, dressing a wound, or lighting a lamp, they're impossible. The lights have gone out. The running water's been cut off. The supermarket shelves are empty. A famine isn't at all unlikely. It doesn't really matter what the crop is. The whole harvest has perished. It doesn't seem too much of an exaggeration, does it? As verse 12 says, that gladness has been eaten up by the locusts. All the luxury goods, figs, apples, pomegranates, I mean anything that grows on a tree has been consumed. There's nothing left to look forward to. All the pleasures have been sucked out of life in one fell swoop. Verse 17, it goes on, the granaries and the storehouses are desolate. That's everything that you've saved up for the future. All your investments gobbled up before your eyes in the space of a few hours. That's your insurance policy failing, your bank folding. The rainy day that you were saving up for has come, but it's completely destroyed the things you thought would bail you out. Verse 18 tells us that meat and dairy aren't going to be on the menu much longer. Cows and sheep have nothing to eat either. Even wild animals, verse 20, are suffering from the effects of the drought. Everything's gone. God's judgment has taken away everything. The things you worked for in the past, the things you need to get through today, the things you'd stored up for the future. It'll likely to take decades to work back to where you started off. Trees take years to regrow. It'll take years to build up a stockpile of grain big enough to get a decent harvest from. Flocks of cows and sheep take years to breed. You're looking at decades of hunger, decades of hard work and poverty to put this back together. Decades you can never get back. And that's if you don't starve. And that should make it needless to say that this judgment from God is unbearable. It's unbearable. If the punishment only affected one area of life, perhaps you could cope. Look at the bright side. Enjoy what you had left. But there is no upside, no bright side of life to look on here. There's no coping with a judgment that's all-consuming. You can see that from the way people react in the passage. Words like weeping, wailing, mourning, lamenting. I counted 7 times those words are used in the passage. Drunkards weep and wail. Priests mourn and wail. The land itself mourns. Farmers wail and are shamed. Everybody's fasting and wearing sackcloth. Imagine it, the despair of seeing your whole life eaten up before your eyes and there's nothing, nothing at all that you can do. You'd totally lose it, wouldn't you? What's to hold back complete despair when God has taken away everything? If God is against us, what can possibly be for us? Everyone's bawling in the streets. Everyone's crying like a baby. Verse 8 says, crying like a woman whose fiancé has just died. What else is there to do? I can think of a few outpourings of national grief in my life. I think probably the death of Lady Di would be one of the biggest ones here in Britain. I was genuinely moved at the real sorrow in Singapore earlier this year at the death of Lee Kuan Yew. it was clear a whole country was mourning. But it wasn't really like this. Nothing like the public weeping and wailing that's described here. All-consuming, unbearable judgment. But it was at least a couple of thousand years ago. Why should we care? It's really important at this point that we're clear that it isn't, so that we'll worry that a plague of locusts might descend upon modern Britain. Britain doesn't relate to God through the covenant, like Israel did. Neither does any other country in the world. We can't use this passage as a way of telling which countries have angered God and which ones have pleased him based on how many disasters they've suffered recently. It would be very wrong of us to assume that the victims of those awful terrorist attacks in France were especially evil people. No, the Bible is clear, sadly, in our broken world, bad things happen to good people all too often, and we simply can't read anything into it when they do. Instead, chapter 2 tells us that we should care because the plague is a sign of things to come. In fact, it's an urgent warning of things to come. Chapter 1 ended with the people crying out to God, telling him about their sufferings, looking for some relief or word of comfort. Chapter 2, 1 to 11 is what they got. Sound the alarm. Blow the trumpet. Set off the air raid sirens. Joel tells his hearers that the locusts point to an even worse disaster just over the horizon. He calls it the day of the Lord in chapter 2 verse 1. The day of the Lord is mentioned a few times in the Old Testament, and it's a way of talking about what we call judgment day. A day when God will fully and finally bring all the sins of the world to account. And the implications for Joel's hearers are clear. Worse is to come. But it is a kind of worse that we should be able to understand better if we look at the locust plague. As you look through chapter 2, you see the judgment to come is described in terms that are just like the locusts, but on a grander scale. If the locust plague was unlike anything anyone had ever seen, well, chapter 2 verse 2 says that this day of the Lord is also unlike anything that's ever been before and anything that ever will be. Just as a virtual army of locusts invaded, so here God has an army that's unstoppable, a vast horde ready to sweep everything in its path. When the day of the Lord comes, the judgment is all-consuming. Verse 3 is pretty comprehensive, isn't it? Fire devours before them, and behind them a flame burns. The land is like the Garden of Eden before them, but behind them is a desolate wilderness, and nothing escapes before them. Paradise is reduced to ashes. But these locusts don't just eat food. Even the earth and the heavens tremble. The sun and the moon turn black and the stars stop shining. This judgment doesn't just consume food. It consumes the entire cosmos. Nothing at all will be left intact. And as they see the army of the Lord described like locusts, completely unstoppable, did you notice the dominant emotion has changed? There's no wailing or weeping when you get to chapter 2. Instead, in verse 1, we get, let all the inhabitants of the land tremble. Before them, the peoples are in anguish, verse 6. All faces grow pale. Verse 10, the earth quakes before them, the heavens tremble. The day of the Lord is great and very awesome. Who can endure it? Sadness has given way to terror. Weeping to trembling. So we should look at the locust invasion and see in it a tiny picture of what's to come. Joel contains an urgent warning to a grieving people. If you think the locusts were bad, that was just the beginning. It's like the teaser trailer that you watch on your iPhone. It lets you know what the feature is about, maybe gives you a feel for the kind of special effects involved. But the feature itself is 100 times longer, in IMAX, with surround sound. The all-consuming, unbearable locust invasion. It's just the warm-up act to get you in the mood. So the big thing Joel wants us to take away as we look at the devastation is the answer to his question in verse 11. The day of the Lord is great and very awesome. Who can endure it? Who can endure this kind of all-consuming judgment that burns up everything you treasure, everything you need to survive, your past, present, and future? Nobody can. Who can endure the unbearable sorrow of living under the undeniable signs of God's anger? Nobody can. Who can escape an army against which no weapon is any use, no wall is any protection, and no home any security? Nobody can. I think it's fair to ask then, does the thought of God's judgment make you tremble? I know if we're trusting in Jesus, we're safe from judgment. But doesn't the thought make you tremble nonetheless? Do we really believe in a day of all-consuming, unbearable, devastating judgment? Every man, woman, and child who has ever lived or will ever live has to face up to this. The day of the Lord is great and very awesome. Who can endure it? If you look in an old hymn book, like this one, you'll probably find a hymn that's called Dies Irae. It was one of the most well-known hymns of the Middle Ages, and it gives you a flavour of what Christians in the past thought about this. Let me read you a bit. Day of wrath, O day of mourning, see fulfilled the prophet's warning, heaven and earth to ashes burning. Oh, what fear man's bosom rendeth when from heaven the judge descendeth, on whose sentence all dependeth. See the book exactly worded, wherein all has been recorded, thence shall judgment be rewarded. When the judge his seat attaineth, and each hidden deed arraigneth, not a sin unjudged remaineth. What shall I, frail man, be pleading? Who for me be interceding, when the just are mercy needing? It actually goes on like this for 19 verses. Apologies for ye olde English. I know it contains silly words like arraigneth, which my dictionary tells me means to put on trial. But does it give you a sense of how vivid a reality this was to Christians in the past? This was one of their most well-known hymns. This coming day clearly weighed on their minds, on their consciences. Has it become a bit weightless to us? Doesn't it all seem just a little bit, well, medieval? Maybe a bit over the top? Oh, sure, we believe in judgment like they did, but please, let's not make a fuss about it. I certainly think that that's too often the way that I've thought about these things. Joel is calling us to change our mind about the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord is great and very awesome. It should loom large in our minds. It's understandable in a way that it should have taken such a back seat. We live in a world where the idea that God could or would judge us like this is seen as being beneath contempt. While I was preparing this talk, someone very close to me put up a picture on her Facebook wall. It's just a picture of a woman with a glass of wine and the caption, "I already know I'm going to hell. At this point, it's really go big or go home." I just stared at it and thought, you have no idea, not the faintest idea of the things that you're talking about. But of course she's joking. She doesn't expect for a minute to go to hell. For her, the day of the Lord isn't great and very awesome. It's laughable. It's the stuff of medieval fanaticism or nutters in sandwich boards. I know because I've spoken to her about it before that she's never looked into Christianity in her life. and she has no plans to. There isn't even the sense of, whoa, if this is true, it's a terrifying enough prospect that I should at least look into it. The very thought that it could be real is insane. Let's be clear. Almost none of our friends and neighbours are going to encourage us to treat the idea of a universal day of judgment with anything less than complete contempt. It will take a positive effort to keep it on the agenda. The day of the Lord is great and very awesome. Who can endure it? Do we ever dare to think that perhaps it won't be so bad for people like my friend after all? Do we kid ourselves that it will somehow be unpleasant but basically tolerable for them? Do we push the thought out of our heads that judgment will be all-consuming, that it will be unbearable? There'll be no wisecracks on that day, only trembling. And of course, if modern Westerners don't believe in a day of judgment, they build a culture to match. We live in a world where, for most people, entertainment is the main purpose in life. Whether it's sports or films or Game of Thrones or sex, we live in a world of endless distractions and preoccupations. And as we live our day-to-day lives in that culture, it becomes harder and harder to concentrate on the day of the Lord. After all, there are only so many ideas that can share one person's headspace. There are only so many days your life can be built around. There are only so many truths that can grip your imagination. There can be only so many preoccupations which shape the kind of decisions that feed into major life choices. I guess Joel says to us, guys, shouldn't the day of the Lord be one of them? Isn't the day of the Lord more worthy than our careers, or than the latest season of Top Gear, or the newest viral video sensation? I'm not saying it's wrong to be interested in sport or to watch TV, and there are some things that we need to be thinking about: how to do our jobs, how to look after our children, how to pay the bills. But if this is at all true, shouldn't it be one of the things at the forefront of our minds? And if it isn't now, isn't something else going to have to give so it can take its place? What would that be for you, I wonder? Of course, I'm not saying that this should be the only thing you should think of day and night. You'd go insane. There have been times when it's been almost unbearable even to do the thinking for writing this talk. No, we have to bear in mind God's sovereign control, Jesus' death for our sins, the new creation. But the day of the Lord is great and very awesome. Who can endure it? Shouldn't it at least have a place at the table with those other things? Wouldn't we understand them all better if it took that place? Well, thank God, that's not all Joel has to say. We're going to be hearing a lot more in the coming weeks about God's grace and his plans for his people to survive the day of the Lord. Understood rightly, Joel is a book that should fill us with gratitude and purpose and hope. But if it's going to do that, we have to deal with this day. We have to allow Joel's question to shape our thinking. The day of the Lord is great and very awesome. Who can endure it?